This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and myself, Mimi Rosenberg. Trump's Mexico tariffs were always about white nationalism and pose an incendiary threat to an imaginary border crisis, but they may also be about gaining leverage against Mexico and the Democrats seeking modifications in the upcoming USMCA, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement. And we speak with
Laura Carlson, head of the Center for International Policy's America's Project in Mexico City, and Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic Policy Research, CEPR, in Washington, D.C., and president of Just Foreign Policy, a non-governmental organization dedicated to reforming U.S. foreign policy.
There was yet another tweet or discourse where Mexico that said in response to Trump, Trump said, look, I can renew these threats of tariffs any single time I want. Mexico has negotiated a secret agreement with us. This is not the time to reveal it. We will in weeks to come, but it'll be on our terms. And if not, we're going to restore the tariffs any single time we want. Well, the president of Mexico and the Mexico administration said there is no secret agreement. There are no new tariffs, but the question is that now tariffs are firmly linked, tariffs and trade, to immigration. Let's begin with Trump, alpha male, you know, his throwdown, the gauntlet to Mexico. What actually is afoot here that we know about what impact the tariffs have had and how this is affecting refugees from Mexico and Central America? And maybe we can start there with Laura.
Well, thanks very much first for the invitation to be on the show, Ken and Mimi. It's always a pleasure. The tariffs, of course, did not go into effect, but they did have Mexico worried because Mexico, in order for the new government to carry out its fairly ambitious reform program, particularly in terms of social programs, it needs financial stability. And because of the degree of dependency that Mexico has on the United States economy with more than 80% of its trade with a single nation, stability means being cool with the United States, even under a Trump government. So we've seen throughout the presidency, which has just been since December of last year, of Andrés Manuel López Obrador, that he's been trying to placate Donald Trump, despite some pretty deep disagreements they have, one of them being, of course, on immigration. The agreement that went through, it's true that it's primarily about measures that were already in place. There are two programs, essentially. One is what Mexico does on the southern border, which is to say the militarization, this promise to send 6,000 National Guard to the southern border to basically crack down on Central American migrants. That's been going on for a while. The new promise of 6,000 is new, but the crackdown's been going on at least since Trump threatened to close the border a couple months ago. Then the other part of it is the expansion of what's known as the Remain in Mexico program. And this is a program that we have warned from the very beginning, before it came into effect, that they should not buckle to the Trump administration with its anti-immigrant, white nationalist agenda and accept this. But they did as the lesser of two evils, and I'll talk about the second evil in just a second. And basically it means that people go to the United States, they request asylum, Central Americans, and they send them back to Mexico to await their asylum hearing, which I was just in Tijuana and talking to people there, are taking up to a year now. They've got people going back and forth, and nobody knows the rules, and it's utter confusion. Meanwhile, the border cities on the Mexican side are getting congested. Now with this expansion, they're talking about sending back some 60,000 Central Americans. The greater evil that Mexico managed to avoid is something that's usually called a safe third country agreement. And that means that these people wouldn't even be able to request asylum in the United States if they were already in Mexico and Mexico were deemed a safe country. So that would like completely close off any possibility of them even pleading a case for asylum and safety in the United States. And that's something that the Mexican government has rejected for a long time. But it seems to be exactly what Trump is like secretly referring to about this secret agreement in his latest tweet.
Mark Weisbrot, one of the things that you've referenced is the whole issue of linking tariffs to social crises. You also refer to the issue that the imaginary border crisis. So I wonder if you can talk about that. And I have to say that you must Google, if you haven't, Mark's extraordinary work on the use of sanctions against the people of Venezuela to try to weaponize the economy for regime change in Venezuela.
Thanks, Mimi and Ken, for inviting me. Well, now that you mentioned, weaponizing the economy, that is part of what Trump is doing. And one part Laura mentioned, and this is one of the effects of NAFTA and a grave mistake on the part of Mexican policymakers who negotiated this, that 80% of their exports are going to the United States. They did it at a time when it was kind of the worst time to do that because you were just heading into the two largest asset bubbles in the history of the world. One in the stock market bubble and then the recession that followed that and the jobless recovery here. And then there was the housing bubble. And then even before that, you had the peso crisis, 94, 95. And so that was a very bad deal. But then there's big weaponization, I think, now that Trump is using against Mexico is the financial stability. And Laura mentioned that, too. And one of the reasons why Mexico is so vulnerable to that is because of the changes they made in their rules for capital flows and trading currencies. So you can trade currencies on the weekends there. It's one of the most hyper-mobile capital markets in the world. When I mean capital, I mean portfolio, not, foreign direct investment, but the kind of investment that is very often speculative that goes in and out. And you saw the peso fall about 5% in response to this, but that was only because a lot of people didn't expect Trump to follow through. It would have fallen much more. But, to give you one example, in 2013, when the U.S. Federal Reserve just talked about reducing its quantitative easing, that is, the Fed creating money and buying U.S. dollar-denominated assets, especially Treasury bonds, as soon as the Fed announced that, it pushed the Mexican economy practically into recession. Just from that announcement, it wasn't even the end of the quantitative easing. It was just the announcement that they were going to begin to slow it. So that's how sensitive and volatile the Mexican financial markets are to anything that the United States does. And especially in this case, if they had followed through and started the tariffs, you don't know what it would have done on the financial side. Push the economy into recession. Now, in terms of this crisis, when I wrote that, it doesn't amount to any kind of crisis, I'm referring, of course, to Trump's idea that there's a migration crisis for the United States. There is a crisis for the migrants who are coming here. Obviously, many of them are fleeing violence in their home countries, especially in Central America. But also, the fact that the Trump administration is deliberately not providing the facilities that are needed to process, and the way they are treated, of course, has been infamous here. But that's a crisis actually created by Trump and his administration. The idea that we face a flood of migrants coming here and that creates some kind of crisis in the United States, which is what Trump is promoting even as a legal matter, right? He declared that Mexico presents a national emergency for us, both for the wall and then again to impose these tariffs. So what is the basis for this? And if we look at the actual data, the only data that's recent data that's available measures how many people are trying to enter the United States at the border with Mexico and are unauthorized, which the U.S. government calls inadmissibles, and apprehensions and inadmissibles, that's their category, you only have this last 3 months where it's actually gone up. For 5 years, it's been falling. In 2017, apprehensions reached a near 50-year low. We don't have anything near. We have a small fraction of what we used to have, numbers of people coming across the border in 2000. So, yeah, there's been an increase in these last 3 months, and the average has increased from 60,000 to 90,000 a month. That's a big increase, but we have no idea if that's going to last. There's a lot of evidence that it won't, that it's not a trend at all. These numbers bounce around a lot. So it's all a manufactured thing. And, of course, it's part of Trump's intention to rally his base around racist fears and prejudices. And, you know, Trump is an unusual president in the world. Even almost all dictators in the world try to expand their following beyond their hardcore base. And you can see that Trump doesn't really do that. He's trying to keep this base and feed them this kind of stuff. I mean, his hardcore base that really, you know, thinks that, believes the stuff, right, that we have an immigration crisis. And so he's holding on to them. He doesn't care who he alienates, although he has another base, which is the big corporations and the business roundtable and the Chamber of Commerce. And that was probably the thing that led him to rescind his threats of immediate threats of imposing the tariffs. But nonetheless, he's, you know, this strategy comes out of his strategy for survival as president. He needs to have those 20 Republicans in the Senate that will never defect, and in order that, he has to have a hardcore mobilized, because those are the people that would convict him if he were impeached in the House. That's why he has that strategy, and I think that's why you see these trade war things like this one in particular, because it focuses on immigration, but the other ones are also focused on rallying this part of his base that he thinks he needs in order to make sure that he never gets impeached and convicted.
And Laura, Mexico is still a very poor country, and López Obrador, to his credit, didn't want to take these actions, but really was forced to by this inhuman policy of tariffs by Trump. But how is this playing out in Mexico? Do they have the resources to house and feed all of these refugees? And also, what's going to happen at the southern border?
Well, there's mixed messages coming out of the government, because the discourse has been they still believe that to solve immigration, you have to go to the root causes. There are constant statements against a punitive criminalization model like Donald Trump's. But we've been seeing now more than a month of crackdowns at the southern border, including raids, increased detention. More and more, it's beginning to look like the U.S. side of the northern border of Mexico. There's a commitment to human rights, and there's a commitment to taking another approach, but there's also a strong commitment to trying to placate Donald Trump. And those are irreconcilable positions, that someday something's going to give. It was actually impressive the way that they came out of this one. Of course, there's a lot of criticisms from our organization and others that 6,000 National Guard to the southern border and some of the measures that they actually accepted are going to be disastrous, and they're basically giving way to that model of seeing immigrants as a threat, which they're not. The border cities, and like I said, I was just in Tijuana, which began receiving the asylum seekers that were returned from the United States, and now their El Paso is also receiving a large number of asylum seekers, and some other border cities are going to begin. And there's a huge amount of strain because they're not really receiving any support from either government for this new plan. That means that the migrant shelters that are run by church organizations and community organizations, the legal services that people are trying to provide to families that really deserve asylum to escape death threats and life and death situations in Honduras and Guatemala and El Salvador, they're really saturated. And we're only beginning, if this is true, that we're going to see now an expansion of that program. But again, as Mark says, this whole crisis is manufactured, because all it would take is, for example, in the United States, okay, we have an increase in asylum seekers. We actually should be glad for that. because it means that people, instead of going across the border illegally and attempting to, you know, and then and living as undocumented in the United States, are now formally delivering themselves to the Border Patrol, getting registered, and asking for asylum. That is orderly migration. That's the international law on this. You know, that creates, that's part of the system, and it's certainly their right. And we're talking mostly, and this is the other big change in the immigration that we've seen, about women and children. Everybody knows that desperate women and children are not constituting a national security threat to the United States. So it's kind of unfathomable to me, from Mexico City and being a U.S. citizen as well, to understand how this debate even got as far as it did in terms of this trumped-up border crisis and this trumped-up need for a crackdown, as if American communities were somehow threatened by these people who I've had a chance to talk to and to get to know, and who in no way constitute a threat to U.S. communities, and who have an international right to seek asylum.
Laura, one of the other things that concerns me greatly, the issue of appeasement. Mexico, Obrador, caught between a rock and a hard place, right? You know, Mexico is the third largest trade partner. It's our closest neighbor and actually an ally, but it has enormous internal policy problems economically and so on. So how frightened should we be that this bullying using tariffs can drive what is a left-center government to create yet further appeasements and actually move to the right from this bullying? Is that something that you find profoundly of concern?
Yes, definitely. Mark talked about the vulnerability of the Mexican economy to the United States, the international markets and the investment and the currency exchange. And they're very aware of that. I would say that that has been probably one of the biggest impediments to having a more progressive agenda in Mexico. That's going to be an irreconcilable conflict because of the constant provocations from Donald Trump. No matter what you do, now that he's decided that immigration and Mexico bashing is going to be the centerpiece of his reelection campaign, it's never going to go down well, and it's never going to stop. So at some point, you know, Mexico is trying to figure out what line to walk that will keep it from suffering the gravest repercussions and yet somehow be able to maintain some kind of a principled position. There's also a lot of conflict within the López Obrador administration. We've got to say it. You know, it has not been so clear that they're willing to take that strong human rights position. They have business people and the and major forces in the Mexican business community, which under NAFTA, of course, is completely transnationalized, that are saying, do whatever you have to do. If Donald Trump asks you to do it, do it, you know. Well, the rest of the society, in large part, is saying, hey, you promised us that this would be a different kind of government, and we're still waiting to see it.
And Mark, the thing that gets lost in this whole thing is the cause of the crisis to begin with, which is the abysmal conditions, both economically and in terms of crime, in the Central American countries that we're talking about. And just recently, Trump pulled out economic aid from Guatemala. What is our responsibility in terms of development of those countries, economic development, and how did we get into the situation to begin with of supporting the dictatorships in many of these countries?
Can I just add one piece to that? And the only candidate in the Democratic camp that I've heard speak about Central America and what needs to be done, one component was Julian Castro,
right,
who was talking about what we really need is, if we were dealing with the issue of refugees, etc., was a Marshall Plan. So I just
and
wanted
Lopez
to...
And López Obrador was talking about something similar.
Yeah. Yeah, Mark?
Yeah, I'd tell for them not destroying these countries first before we get to the stage of actually helping them. There was actually a nice op-ed in the New York Times the other day about how accepting migrants is a form of reparation and to the countries, Central America and other countries as well. You know, just to take first the long haul before we get to recent, something recent, but, you know, Mexico was a fast-growing, developing country from the 1950s to 1980. From 1960 to 1980, income per person doubled. They were on their way. In fact, that's huge. I mean, by the way, you know, from 80 to 2000, it only grew by about 13%. So you had real gains in Mexico in this period that is now looked upon as some kind of policy failure by the most of the media and people that are cited in the media. So this was a huge economic failure from 1980 on, and it continued after NAFTA, which locked in the policies, the neoliberal policies, and some which I just described, the ones that caused all the financial instability, but and of course the trade dependence, but the United States. But all of these things were engineered by the United States. If you didn't have these changes, and Mexico had just continued to grow at the rate that it did prior to 1980, Mexico would actually have European living standards today. That would be the straight line projection. And nobody would be coming here from Mexico. And in fact, anybody who got into Mexico from Central America would stay there and not be trying to get in here. Of course, they've done, the U.S. government has done so much to destabilize not only Mexico, but much more and more violently in Central America. In 2009, of course, you all know, there was a military coup in Honduras, and that was aided and abetted and consolidated by the U.S. government. Hillary Clinton wrote in her memoirs that she helped make sure that the democratically elected president could not return to the country. And then you have the whole history of what the UN later found to be genocide in Guatemala, starting, with the coup in 1954. That was a CIA coup. And this continued through successive administrations all the way into the 90s. So that's a huge part of the poverty and the violence. You know, it's no coincidence that the Northern Triangle countries, Guatemala and Honduras and El Salvador in particular, they all have these horrible problems with violence, that people are fleeing, the highest homicide rates in the world. This comes out of the enormous and continuous and decades of violence that really came from the United States.
I made some suggestion that some of this was a preparatory threat to eke out or thwart the modifications that the Democrats and Mexico were seeking in upcoming USMCA trade agreements. And any thoughts on that, Mark?
Yeah, well, I mean, it does seem like Trump is threatening Mexico, and that could be related to the negotiations over trade and this so-called NAFTA revision. I mean, you just never know what they're really driving for, because there's so much of this is just posturing. I think that they do want certain things in all of these trade wars besides the distraction element of it and the political element here. They want, greater protections for U.S. companies and U.S. investors primarily, and especially the pharmaceutical industry and things like that. So I think that it could be related to that, but it's not clear, because there are so many other motives involved. So much of it is designed to rally his base and to show that he can deliver. That's how the Trump administration and Fox News and their media are framing the whole thing, that he tells Mexico what they have to do, and they give in. And, he's going to probably these numbers, which are, these 3 months, the only 3 months that you actually have out of the last 5 years, that you had a significant increase in migration. You know, like other data that's volatile and is subject to temporary influences, they'll probably go down in the next few months, and then he'll claim victory again. And they'll probably go down because, some of the reasons that they went up, there's researchers who have looked at this. Some of it was just you had, for instance, the price that the coyotes were charging the people who bring people across the border had dropped quite significantly for various reasons, or because Trump created the influx himself by making people think that it was going to be now or never if anybody wanted to escape. And so there are things that are temporary, and they'll go down, and then he'll claim victory again.
And Laura, we're going to give you the last word, but for goodness sakes, speaking really as a lawyer, most of the things that's happening aren't illegal. It's asylum seekers immediately reporting to authorities for processing, nothing more. But your final thoughts on this entire issue?
Well, first of all, as Mark says, this isn't a border crisis. The numbers we're seeing are not unprecedented or unmanageable. What's happening is actually a much more legal process than what we've seen in the past at some of the peak immigration moments in the past, in the early 2000s. And all the United States really has to do is assign more asylum officers to hear and give due process to these families who are escaping conditions that the United States government in large part created. I wanted to also add on the aid issue that we have to be careful about this. When Trump announced that he was cutting off aid for Central American countries, a lot of progressives jumped in to say, no, you can't do that. You'll be shooting yourself in the foot, you know, as if he ever had good intentions for these countries. And the thing is, as Mark says, first of all, stop doing harm, you know, before you even talk about aid. And we know, as progressives, from decades of experience, that U.S. aid more often does harm than good. The Berta Cáceres Act in Congress right now that's being relaunched is supported by every single major human rights organization in Honduras to cut off all police and military aid to Honduras. And the kind of aid Trump wants to give is to close off borders between countries that actually have a mobility pact. And when you don't permit your own citizens to leave your country, you're an authoritarian state. Is that really what we want for Central America again? It's going to make the political crisis that are already almost, you know, already explicit, Honduras, an illegitimate government, Guatemala, a government that's been tagged for corruption and is entering a very unstable electoral period, El Salvador, which is entering a new presidential period, Nicaragua, obviously, in crisis, although there are much fewer immigrants from that country. You know, this is a situation we're facing, and nobody's talking about the real roots of the crises
and
that
Laura,
people are facing.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. We will continue these discussions. Laura Carlson, head of the Center for International Policy Americas Project in Mexico City, and Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Thank you. Thank you for informing us.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.